Okay, we're doing this. Welcome back. And here I am with Vinay and Sanjula. Great to see you guys.
Good to be back.
A lot going on.
We've been busy.
A lot been going on.
I haven't really seen the two of you. We've all been in different places.
Yeah, I had the bio conference yesterday or the day before.
We've been to Stanford, San Diego, Boston. We've been doing our CEO listening tour. We've now done four places, including the FDA. And we have heard a ton of things. So many, I think, consistent themes across all the things, but also at every single forum we go to, we hear new ideas, new ways we could do a better job, and it's been a really productive listening experience.
Yeah, it's amazing when you get the CEOs and leaders of these companies, drug developers, inventors, the scientists in the room, and you say, this is a safe space, tell us your ideas for an FDA that works better for you. It's amazing. They will talk, they will unload, they will share, and so they did. And, you know, we took a little heat, and I knew this was going to happen because we did it as a closed-door meeting. I mean, we might have had 70 to 120 people, depending on the city, in the room for it being closed-door. We took, you know, and people, we all believe in radical transparency. But if you want someone to be honest and genuine and sharing their ideas, you have to create a safe space for them. And since we were not answering questions, we were not giving talks, we're not sharing new information from the FDA, we were listening. It was amazing how many people told us when they don't have to worry about their shareholders and their employees and investors and everybody else, how they just felt comfortable giving ideas, and they gave us a lot of ideas.
Yeah, and we can be transparent in what we're thinking and what we're gonna do at FDA, but it's really not our role to force companies for telling their deepest, darkest secrets to the whole world. And in fact, by doing it behind closed doors, and again, we're just listening to what they're saying and writing notes and kind of saying back to them what we hear them saying, we learned a lot, and they talked about sort of frustrations they may face in all directions, from, you know, how they get their funding, the challenges they face with running their operation, and how FDA has made things easier and harder. And that's the other thing. We all got a lot of praise, too. You know, one person spoke about how the FDA is also doing a good job, let's not forget. But there are ways we could do better.
Thanks for throwing that in.
Yeah, yeah, right. I think it's to the listening point, though. I think it's worth sharing the format in which you did it, right? And you guys were truly listening because each attendee had, what, it was about 2 minutes, and they were on the clock, and they could just openly share what they wanted to say.
Good thing we were listening because my voice was shot.
I think you're still recovering.
Yeah, he's had a rough voice for this last week. But yeah, like a couple of the forums, literally every single person took a microphone and spoke from 1 to 2 minutes. In the forums that were just so big, we took a line and just let people go. But again, the whole thing was just letting people talk about frustrations they face. And of course, you know, there's certain themes that come across it that we'd be happy to talk about.
I had some FOMO because I didn't get to join the last few. So were there a couple of highlights of new themes you were hearing?
It's like a third of the feedback was a common theme in all the sessions. And I'd say two-thirds was unique and you know, very different. And they were very specific ideas that were formative for us. These are things we can implement and act on or, you know, run by our own staff. So, for example, we were just talking about the value of creating a safe space for someone to share their ideas. That's how we're doing it here. We'll meet with physicians, scientists, reviewers, core staff at the agency. And we ask them, you know, what ideas do you have? How could things be done bigger? Has there been something you've wanted to do but not been able to do? If you have their bosses or their next three bosses right next to them, then it's a very different amount of feedback, right? Then it's all of a sudden everything's great and thanks to the leadership of my boss. Right, but if you create a safe space, there's good ideas, and we got a lot of those good ideas.
So I took some of the ideas I heard, and I went to my team at CBER today, and just with some reviewers, I tossed them out there. So I've heard this, I've heard that. What do you think about it? And oftentimes they say, yeah, there's a point there. I agree with this part of it. This is the part I might push back a little bit. This is the nuance that I would add. And so again, it's a two-way thing. We want both the staff here to feel listened to and heard, which we're working on. I'm doing individual meetings with reviewers now, you know,
that's great.
Working my way through. And also, I think the companies, and I do think there are places where they both completely agree. And those are the things that we just have to match up. And the places where they disagree, I think we'd have to, you know, see which way we should move on those those points.
So earlier this week, then, you made an announcement, Commissioner, that I think really addresses some of that feedback you've heard around this priority voucher program. You want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, so we're trying something new. We're trying something called the National Priority Review Voucher Program, and it's going to be a decoupling of the application so that the lion's share of the application can be submitted before that final NDA, BLA application. And we could tailor this to other aspects of FDA applications that we receive. But in this pilot program, we're going to see if we can get that review time down from a standard 10 to 12 months down to weeks or a couple months. And the goal is to create an exercise where we review all the wasted time in the process. We're not cutting any corners in the scientific review. It's the same scientific review. But it never made sense to me that companies would sit around waiting for their clinical trials to finish. And there's all that idle time, and it's not being utilized. And when they submit the final application, you're looking at manufacturing data that really had nothing to do with the final outcome of the clinical trial. So by getting most of it in, and then once the clinical trial is done, those endpoints are submitted in sequence. Initially, the top line results, so that the reviewers can hone in on where they're going. And then the actual last, you know, component of the application with all the signatures and little steps. And by just cutting all the wasted steps, we think there's a tremendous opportunity to get that down significantly. If we can reduce some of the R&D costs and animal testing, as we've announced in our plan to reduce animal testing, cut down that 6 months of animal testing where applicable, as the organ-on-a-chip technology improves and where the computational modeling gets better and better at predicting toxicity, better than the animal testing. And then on, you know, throughout the entire process, we have enhanced communication with this pilot program. This is something that was a common theme on the CEO listening tour. A 15-minute call sort of quickly could save them months of guesswork. And so mind reading is a bad thing in any setting in the world.
I think it's worth, just for those who may be less familiar with the process today, right, without this voucher program. So what you're saying is typically what happens now if the manufacturer has a question of a comment they get from a reviewer. I heard in one of the forums it was like up to 90 days sometimes to get a quick answer. So you're saying now we can have more real-time feedback for a 15-minute call so you're not waiting 90 days.
So that's just like, that's just the tip of the iceberg of the commissioner's plan. But of course, yeah, there's a tiered system and manufacturers at a different time. There is a clarification process that exists now. But having a more open dialogue, quicker conversations, that can speed up a lot of this process. But the current process, once we get the completed application, can still take, you know, up to a year to make a decision on a product, yes or no. And the commissioner, I think, is talking about a program where we get that down to 2 months. Now, time, of course, is money, but time is also patient lives. I mean, shaving that amount of time is lives potentially saved from beneficial products entering faster, people with less disability who are living and functioning better. So there's this huge patient need to do it. I've heard a lot of people, and there's also the financial part, which is that every month the companies wait, they are losing money, and that also means their investments in making new products has diminished. So this solves two of these problems. I've heard a lot of praise from the industry, especially people who are long time said, you got to get this time faster, including very esteemed CEOs of really major corporations. But I've also seen some criticism from some of the people in the past who were the biggest proponents of FDA cutting down the bureaucracy. And their criticism is, you know, who are you to decide who gets to have these lottery tickets? And the answer is, you know, my first answer is, why don't you see how it goes and then see if you disagree with the picks? Let the picks come and then tell us if you don't think those are the most impactful sort of things that are really in the best interest of the American people.
Large unmet public health needs where you can have a huge impact. National priorities such as the domestication of manufacturing, moving manufacturing, onshoring it, that's a national security issue. And pandemic preparedness, for example, we have to have a good system set up. You know, during the first year of the pandemic, they stood up basically a special system to review the COVID application. And they did it in a relatively short period of time without even doing some of these novel techniques of decoupling the application, moving ahead the CMC portion. So we know it's possible. The question is the resources involved, where the wasted time is. We'll have a committee to decide who gets the initial round of vouchers. I wish we could do it agency-wide, but the way you learn is that you have to do things in iterations and start with a small pilot. And once we figure this out, then we can build on those learnings. But we can't keep doing the same thing.
Yeah, you have to try new things. You have to be an innovative organization. That's one of the longtime criticisms of government. We're going to try something new. As you say, a committee is going to be in charge of picking this. I'll have three votes, right, Marty? No, but it's going to be a committee of diverse experts sort of thinking about these priorities. And ultimately, I think that the critics should let it happen and then see what you think. See what the picks are and see if you think that those aren't really useful things for the American people.
And I think it's worth noting for people who are less familiar with this that there is some precedent for this, as you mentioned, during the pandemic. But the agency has a history of some of these kind of voucher programs. Now, this is a little bit different, right? It's focused on national priorities. They're not transferable, right? So there are some nuances here, but it's not like this is, you know, we have some practice with this as an agency.
We were talking with the team today about a drug that really offers tremendous benefits, almost like benefits, I don't want to use a particular word, which might even give away what the drug is, that's why I checked myself. A drug that really offers tremendous benefits to patients in neglected domains of their life, okay? And then we asked this team, if you really had this application on your desk tomorrow, and they fully understand the gravity of the situation, how fast can you turn it around? And they said, you know, a month or 2 months is quite reasonable for us to do it. And so not only is there a precedent, there's a will. I think the people here who believe in transformational products believe it can be done. And so I think it's a pilot, and let's see what we do.
And I think one of those components you've talked about, Marty, is around the tumor board style kind of decision making. What is that?
Well, it's interesting because when I've had questions about certain products here at the FDA, the FDA staff will often offer to do a briefing. And what they'll do is they'll come and present the data, present the trial results, and that way I'm informed. So after they make a decision, if I'm asked about it, I'm in the loop. And you know, I say, like, do what you think is best in your best scientific judgment. But it's been very informative to get these briefings. And the briefings are so good. The data is consolidated and presented in such a concise way that I thought, this is a little bit like tumor board, where we have these very complex patients with very complicated histories and on many different trials and medications and so forth, and they're presented in a very concise way where a multidisciplinary group of experts can weigh in. And after that very clean presentation, we all go around and render our ideas. And sometimes we'll officially do a vote. And so it does seem like a tumor board style meeting at least to review the clinical trial results.
Right.
And that's what editorial boards do. That's what the New England Journal, JAMA editorial boards are doing. That's what we do at Tumor Board. We're making these team-based decisions. And sometimes it's good to have somebody who's a little bit of a fresh eye, you know, somebody who is, you know, a radiation oncologist or an oncologist weighing in on the surgical approach. Sometimes it's helpful to have that the fresh eye.
So I think I completely agree with that. And another key aspect of a tumor board style discussion, so what Marty means is, like, what is a tumor board? A tumor board is you're presenting a patient that's complex, perplexing, you don't know what to do, and you're hearing from a surgical oncologist, a radiation oncologist, a medical oncologist, sometimes even the patient's general internist, sometimes the infectious disease doctor, sometimes the consulting rheumatologic service or endocrinology service if they're managing a particular complication. You're hearing from diverse doctors, and you're trying to get a better understanding. And I think one of the points here is that the FDA has maybe too often thought of that only the dengue virus researcher can contribute to a dengue virus vaccine development program. Only the, I'm an oncologist by training, but also a general internal medicine doctor by training. Only the oncologist can only think about AML, and it can only think about myeloma. But sometimes when you're in the room and there's an infectious disease doctor who doesn't know a lot about myeloma, but they may ask a very astute question about the trial design because they're remembering something from an infectious disease trial that didn't seem like it was related, but actually is related in terms of sequential hierarchical design or sort of the Bayesian calculation or some statistical point from something else. And so what Marty's talking about is sometimes people who are curious and thoughtful can help shape decisions and help you decide on products. You can get people from different disciplines to kind of weigh in on really important products, and I think it can be a much richer and more beneficial conversation.
Look, every board in the world brings people from different vantage points to make decisions and to vote. Every editorial board, every corporate board, every setting where you have tumor boards, they're bringing in different perspectives. For example, in editorial boards, there's always a statistician or epidemiologist that is a part of the review. Now, they may not be familiar with the details of angioedema,
right,
but they're bringing in a fresh perspective, and sometimes that's good for discipline. They'll say, look, if we're following the laws of statistics, this is in bounds or out of bounds.
Right.
And so I think that's a healthy perspective. You know, I wish we could just do this on a broad scale, but we have to get it right, so that's why it's going to be a pilot. And we have to be cognizant of the fact that we have a limited resource, and that is the number of scientific reviewers. Now, no scientific reviewer was laid off with the reduction in force, but there's normally a turnover, and we're hiring scientists and doctors.
Hiring vigorously.
At CBER,
I just saw the new job postings go up. Oh, by the way, if you're watching right now and you're a medical reviewer, a scientific reviewer, look at USA.gov job postings and consider applying.
It's a great place to work.
It's a great place to work.
It's exciting. I think we're going to learn a lot from the pilot, and then we'll go from there. And so I think the question now is timeline. And so I know the team is working really hard to get all the application kind of details together, and we'll be sharing that in the next couple of weeks.
That's right. And you can get 3 votes on the committee. So I'm happy to grant that to you.
Good.
Everyone's going to have 3 votes.
Oh, okay.
Everyone gets three votes. You will get your 3 votes.
You know, the other thing I'd say about the pilot program is that one of the big barriers in any broad, big institution in government is to show people what's possible. And you don't have to show it that many times before you kind of open a door in someone's mind. Because we all get trapped into thinking, particularly those of us who worked in hospitals, that what's possible, what's not possible. Somebody comes along in medicine once in a while, and they do something different, and then suddenly that door is open in your mind. And what's possible is now.
And let's be very honest. Can I be very honest?
Please.
All right, I'm going to be very honest. We have been getting clocked by other countries that have created an accelerated pathway for preclinical IND in phase 1. And that's new. That's in the last couple of years. And so unless we can innovate and be competitive, then falling back to sort of protectionist strategies is not really a great path forward. So we've got to try new things. So I just wanted to point out we have a very competitive international landscape. And we have support, too. I just met with the head of the European Medicines Agency, Emma Cook, and with Lawrence Tallon, head of the UK version of the FDA for drugs and medications and devices. And they're looking at Australia and China, and they're saying, hey, wait a minute, if we don't figure this out, if we don't figure out how to use big data in a way to create synthetic controls, if we don't figure out how to streamline these IRB decentralized amalgams that companies have to deal with, which is, you know, I think you and I have been fighting IRBs our entire life.
Exactly. I've been avoiding them. I do meta research for a reason, to skip the IRB, because it's largely exempt.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. If other countries are getting ahead of us, we have to ask ourselves one question. Are they doing it through negligent shortcuts, or are they getting ahead of us by cutting unnecessary bureaucracy? And in some cases, it's a little bit of both, to be honest. We're not going to follow them in negligent shortcuts. But when it comes to cutting unnecessary bureaucracy, we have to follow some other countries. There's some countries that have taken the lead, particularly in the phase 1 space. And that's just not, yeah. The United States cannot retain the dominant biomedical position if literally all of the phase 1s in the world are done abroad. That's not a tenable position. We have to bring that back. And that means in some cases, we got to think even beyond the FDA, how HHS and CMS can help us in this quest.
You know, it's such a delicious point. It just makes me want to have a Kraft Heinz product.
Oh, what a
good segue.
Or a General Mills product, or maybe a Danone yogurt, something like that. I just feel a craving for it right now.
So you're referring to the recent news from those organizations saying that they're committing to removing our petroleum-based food dyes from their products, which is really exciting to
see.
No
way. They did what?
And I thought Kraft went further. It's not just petroleum-based. It's all artificial.
All artificial dyes.
Yeah.
So thank you to Kraft Heinz. Thank you to General Mills. And the pledge to get it out of their food is a pretty aggressive timeline, which is exactly what we wanted. So.
And I had missed this, in reading those, I had missed this like a couple weeks ago. I think also Sam's Club said they're going to do something similar around their products as well. So it's great to see a lot of these companies starting to to work towards our goal here.
Yeah, a bunch more companies too out there, probably too many to mention. Dunkin' Donuts actually has done it, except for I think the sprinkles which go on their some lid donuts.
I saw something on social media. There was a brand, I don't know if I can name them, that's starting to say welcome to the club, right? It's like, oh, we've been doing this, you know, for years, and so it's nice to see other companies and organizations follow suit. Oh, so it's fun to see this kind of consumer movement. And you know, while you guys were at one of the CEO forums, I was with the Consumer Brand Association, which represents a lot of these big companies, and you know, we had a great discussion. They've been really great, and they're really excited to kind of work with us and support a lot of these broader objectives. And, you know, they're all on board, and they're trying to figure out how to do this. And I have to say, Marty, they extended a compliment to you because they said that they've never seen this level of engagement from the FDA. So back to and from the at the commissioner level. And so to bring the F back in the FDA, I think they're all really seeing that.
The F stands for food, not federal. All credit goes to Kyle Diamantis. I just talked to him this morning. It was really a great day. Touched base with Kyle on this incredible enthusiasm for removing artificial food dyes. We had a great talk with Rick Pastor. Matter of fact, we should have just told him to come over here with us.
We should have had him join us.
I mean, there's a lot. There's just a lot going on in cancer right now, and it's exciting.
And he's done a lot of exciting things around rare disease, and we talked to him about some of that. What's that book that Kyle was telling you about where it tells you what a breaded shrimp is, and it's like 45 lines? Oh.
Standards of Identity.
Standards of Identity. Yeah. Yes.
Have you finished reading all the volumes yet, Marty, to get prepared for this show?
I'm on page 132. I'm at mayonnaise. What defines mayonnaise?
Interesting. Yeah, I'm curious. I haven't followed that too closely, but I'm curious what they do in that space.
Yeah. Speaking of cancer care, we learned something a little concerning this week at the FDA. And it involves China, and so it's not their fault they're doing this, but we learned that Americans have had therapy whereby, and the FDA in the last administration okayed this, but Americans have their can have their cells removed for cancer treatment, sent to China where they are genetically engineered, that is genetically edited, sent back to the United States where it's then infused back into an American. And so from a pure national security standpoint, it sounds very concerning.
And the name of the patient and personal health information can be attached to the sending of the cells, which I think is a tremendous vulnerability. And you're right, the prior administration turned a blind eye to this and it just came to our attention. And I think what people don't recognize is, of course, increasingly cells are recognized for being able to be engineered into being potent killers of targets that are preferentially found on cancer. But of course, the worry is cells can be engineered to be potent killers of targets that can be found anywhere. And so one of the vulnerabilities, I think, from allowing American cells to be sent to other countries with patient health information and names attached.
Hostile countries.
Is, of course, the risk of what happens to those products abroad. And they may not always be adequately tested. There may not be ways to test them all fully on the way back in. And so this is a big concern.
Yeah, I mean, you think about the possibilities, and it's a little frightening. So we love CAR T therapy. We love cell therapy
love
and
it.
Gene therapy. But we'd like to see that work done in the United States or among our sort of friendly countries, countries friendly to the United States. So I guess we'll take a look at that. That was something, it's interesting what you learn.
Yeah, I can't talk about everything, but just in CBER, I will tell you that, you know, safety is something very important to the FDA. And of course, there's national security safety, there's safety of privacy, there's safety of Americans' information, there's safety of drug products. And just in the course of these 6 weeks I've been on the job here, a number of really important safety concerns have been brought to my attention. For different drug products in CBER, which governs a huge class of things from vaccines to gene therapy to biologics. And in every single case, we can assure the American people we take it extremely seriously. We leverage the power of big data to quantify safety signals. This is something I think people don't fully understand. Safety signals will never be adequately and fully captured based on prospective randomized controlled trials. That's not possible. That's always been my position, that'll always be my position. Some safety signals can only be detected in large observational data sets that are very carefully matched. We have a number of these safety signals. The response is different. Depending on how good the product is, the response may be to warn people about it, to tolerate it, to give another medicine to try to mitigate it. But in cases where the benefit of the product is more dubious or uncertain, the response may have to be stronger or more swift. And in cases of personal health information, Americans' identity, in cases of national security, I mean, I think we have to be extremely strict and really protect American interests here.
So I saw you put something out. You basically said that we're not going to approve any more of these gene therapies of American patients, that is their cells, in China moving forward from this point forward. That is, we're not going to disrupt the treatment that Americans might be getting. And you want to increase the amount of informed consent. People should know their living cells in the United States are being sent to China for gene editing and then going to be infused back to them. If that's going to happen, they should certainly know with proper informed consent.
I wonder if patients actually, how aware they are that that's happening.
Well, I mean, that's a really great question, which is that what is informed consent and what does it really mean? I mean, having done it on the doctor's side, having witnessed it on the side of, you know, as a fellow being in the room for a lot of protocol consents, as well as for having done protocol consents over the years, I can say that it's a big thing, which is that these consent forms can be very long, and people may not always read all the fine print. And what consent often means is, what are the things the doctor or the counseling provider brings to the patient and patient's family's attention in that brief window of time you have them, which is usually the most salient, the most interesting, the most important concerns. But I do think that people do have a right to know where their cells are being sent and manipulated when they're coming back to them. I do think it's super important not to disrupt people who are in the process of that, who are expectantly waiting for products to be returned to them. I think we got to strike the right balance in how to tackle this, but I think people, a minimum, need to know what's going on with their biological products and their genes and then their living, literally living tissue that can grow. And then we also need to take into account safeguards.
So what I'm hearing you say is we don't want to create hysteria, but chances are most likely there's nothing nefarious going on with the gene editing of these cells of Americans in China being infused back to America and back to these American patients. But proper informed consent is critical. And moving forward, sounds like you're going to take some steps to look into this and to make sure informed consent is accurate.
Absolutely.
Great.
Wow, I learned a lot. I mean, as a non-clinician, I didn't even know that that was something that could happen in a therapy. So,
Maybe Bigfoot can get us closer to the glass of our beautiful campus next time, because we've got like two levels of glass here. So the background may be muted a bit, but it's a gorgeous day.
You've got high standards, Marty, I have to say. I saw the NIH just started their own podcast, and I have
really?
To brag. I think our background is much better than theirs. So.
Our campus is certainly much more beautiful.
Well, I love Jay. You know, Jay's a friend of ours. I saw that. I think we got better production quality. But it's a friendly rivalry.
I love Jay. Our campus is more beautiful, and we have farmers market every week.
That's true.
And it's an amazing group of physicians and scientists here that I've gotten to know, and we're going to keep getting to know them.
And we're hiring.
We're hiring. We're always hiring.
Yeah.
The FDA has always been hiring scientists and should always be hiring scientists and inspectors in the future. We should always have jobs posted.
You know, let me give one more plug there. I've been talking to a lot of the individual reviewers, like in back-to-back meetings for the last few days, and one of the things that comes out to me is I ask people, like, what did you do before you worked at the FDA? And some people were like, I was a allergy immunologist in downtown Washington, D.C., doing largely private practice. Somebody was like, I was a pediatric cardiac intensivist in Arizona, doing private practice. And the reason I say that is that this is somebody who, before they came to the FDA, they hadn't had a lot of experience in regulatory science. They might not have known what a safety label change was or what Section 14 of the drug label was, because that's not the sort of things you think about as a doctor. But they came here open-minded, and they learned all that stuff on the job, and now they know abbreviations and words I don't know. You know. And so our point is that if you're listening and you're a clinician, a scientist, a researcher, and you think to yourself, hey, I don't know if I know enough about FDA and drug regulation to do this job, we will train you on the job. I mean, that's not a barrier to coming to work here. The real question is, are you interested? Are you curious? And if you're curious, you can learn things to your heart's content.
Are you intellectually curious? And do you hate billing and coding? There's no billing
that's
and
true.
Coding. You're not on the treadmill
no
billing
epic
and coding.
Yeah.
Nobody's looking to say, you only saw 26 patients today. Let's try to get that up.
But
a
I'll say
bit.
One more thing. There's some people here who still maintain a half-day clinic in somewhere else. So I've met people here who are still on Tuesdays going to GW or going to Hopkins and running a half-day clinic. So if you still want to practice a little bit, That's also permissible.
We welcome those arrangements, and a lot of people like that. And even when I was heavy in the research years, I kept a hand in the clinical piece in the operating room, and it has tremendous value to a lot of people. For me at this point, I've given it all up.
I was thinking about running, you know, I ran clinic for the 10 years I was attending and up until like 2 days before I came here, and I was thinking about what it would take to kind of continue to run a clinic. But then I realized in this job, it's actually, my particular job would be very difficult.
You got a huge job. Head of CBER, you're also the chief medical and scientific officer for the entire FDA. So we're using all of your talents in so many different ways.
Thanks for that.
So he's very intellectually curious
he
right
is,
here.
He is. Always learning from him.
Thanks.
But we have a lot of amazing people that want to come to the FDA at all levels, scientific reviewers, managers, and top leadership. So it's kind of cool to see all this incredible talent.
And one more thing. I think reviewers should know here and elsewhere that we have your back, too. I was telling every reviewer, is like, I support you pursuing the truth about the application. We will always be flexible. We will think about ways to be faster and more efficient and more flexible and make products available to people with rare disease. We will also always retain the curiosity of pursuing the truth, whatever that truth is of the application. And I will support them in that.
You know, every time there's been a bit of a disaster with a product decision at the FDA, when you go back and, you know, look, and this is, there's nothing in recent time that I can think of in our 11 weeks here, but if you look historically, a whole bunch of people, scientists at the FDA have said, no, don't do this.
Right, they saw it coming. It's
and
always something
one
that
person
was, yeah.
reams it through. And when you look at some of these big public health problems that have started from a decision, that's usually sort of the forensic analysis of the organization or the decision making or the personnel.
And the flip has been true in FDA history. In the 1960s, it was a single reviewer who single-handedly kept thalidomide off the market for, you know, nausea. And that led to the 64 amendments, Kiefer-Harris amendments, that gave the FDA the efficacy authority. So, you know, just as one person can not heed the advice of other people, one person can often be an important person in regulatory history. And you're right. A lot of these things, you look back and you see the die was already cast a long time ago.
For what it's worth, I just have to say, listening to you and just reflecting on conversations I have across the agency, you mentioned people don't, you know, talk in front of their boss, right? So sometimes you'll ask people questions, then you'll leave, and, you know, I got to catch up with them afterwards. Mm-hmm. People ask me what it's like working with the two of you. And I say, you guys are big nerds. You're also scientists, right? And, I mean, truly, like, I watch, and you're talking to scientists, and you're asking them questions about their research, and a lot of them are like, I'm not used to the commissioner asking me questions about my research. And I think that's the kind of place that this is, where you're facilitating that dialogue and discourse to really nerd out on the science and the data. And that's pretty cool to watch.
Well, our job is to support the people here. And so to do that, we have to understand them. And we have to roll up our sleeves. We have to be present. We can't be insular in our sort of cozy central office here. We got to be out there. And you know, when I think about the relationship between doctors and hospital administrators, there's two general types of relationships out there. One is where the administration is completely out of touch with the day-to-day work, and the doctors have a tremendous amount of bitterness, and things don't work as well on the ground as a result. And the other arrangement is where the administration is on the ground, they circulate, they talk, they know the people, and they ask them, what do you need to do your job better? What can I do? What could work function better to make your job work better? And so that sort of in touch, connected relationship, I think, is a recipe for success in any large organization, be it a government or non-government.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I completely agree. As a doctor working there, you're always most frustrated by the people running the hospital who didn't always like to be a doctor. And similarly, to me, the most validating thing is if you tell a reviewer, ask him a question, and they say, actually, you know what, that's a good question, and actually yesterday we asked the company to give us the answer to that question. So it's like, okay, good. Yeah, we're on the same page. We kind of get the science in the same way.
And maybe I'm obsessed with our wonderful cafeteria here, and I eat there all the time because people in the hospital used to say, have you ever seen a senior executive eat in our cafeteria? And then the answer was, no, maybe one, but you never saw them. So, you know, they were out of touch with how horrible the food was, you know? So it's just good to be out there and circulate.
You really do eat there, like almost every day.
Yeah, quickly, though.
Yeah.
In and out.
Quickly, between meetings.
Right. Yeah. Good to see you guys.
Yeah.
Good to see you.
Should we do it again?
Yeah, absolutely.
Or should this be the last episode in our history?
Oh, gosh.
We can let the people put in the comments what they think. But I got a lot of people at the CEO forums watch these videos, and they find it interesting. A lot of people here that watch these videos.
Yeah. Actually, we've been getting a lot of good feedback. Even when I was out with, you know, CBA, they said, can you tell us about the podcast and all of that? So people are watching, and they're sharing comments, and it's
people ask me how frequently and, you know, when does it come out? And you know what? Whenever we get 15 minutes to go just have this conversation, we sort of say, hey, let's walk over there. Let's grab Bigfoot and the team. And Tim, thanks for being here. And so we just come over here and do it.
The crew probably doesn't like it. Yeah, very spontaneous, but yeah. Here we are.
Your name is now known to tens of people worldwide.
Tens of people watching. My mother watching on a loop.
Yeah, five of them are me watching.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
All right, good to see you guys. We'll do it again. Thanks so much.